Welcome. I have to say, I look forward to 2018 then. Based on what Matt said, I'm going to wipe away today. But I want you to know, you never wish life away, because life is for living. So we've got to take the good, the bad, the difference, the adversity, and it's how we make it. But, it's funny, until you actually stop playing and then you go into a second life, you start looking back at what you've done. And I suppose my journey, if you would have said to me so many years ago, I'm in the here and the now, living the life that I'm living, insofar as the organisations I work for, the people I try to represent, I suppose it'd probably be, I probably would have laughed, if I'm being serious with you, because my background is I'm a young man from, family comes from Jamaica, Jamaican parentage. And I grew up in Lewisham, southeast London, which was a fantastic place to grow up. And we lived around Lewisham, Woolwich, Thamesmead, Plumstead, Abbeywood, Brixton, you know, not quite Hampstead, Belsize Park and Mayfair. However, I'm proud of my roots because that's what I stand for. And I was introduced to the church very early in my life. I remember at Lewisham, we had St. Stephen's Church, where I was baptised, and I went to school in Blackheath, which is a school called Blackheath Bluecoats Church of England School. And obviously we were a Christian school and very engaged. But obviously at that point, probably didn't understand enough about it, what it meant, and the impact it was going to have on my life thereafter. Certainly, through one's playing career, faith has been, I suppose, hit me at different levels, at different junctures, at different moments in my life. And, you know, growing up then, probably in the late 70s, it was a very challenging place, particularly around Woolwich, particularly around Charlton. And my career started at Charlton Athletic after being rejected by a number of clubs saying that I wasn't good enough. And being told that you're not good enough is, particularly at that age, is kind of quite heartbreaking. But I say adversity breeds character, and I use that to prove people wrong, not right. And I think, actually, my first rejection is kind of quite symbolic. It was in 1974, and I was at Millwall Football Club, actually. And I had a trial there, and they said, you wasn't good enough, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember my dad coming to pick me up, and he said to me, that's the first time he used the word faith. Keep faith, son, because if you're good enough and you work hard and you want it bad enough and you persevere, everything is achievable. And I remember what was symbolic about then, it's kind of rather funny, because in Woolwich, the very first McDonald's was open, which is true. And my dad said to me, son, I'll tell you how determined I am you're going to make it. And then there was hordes of people queuing up to go to this very first McDonald's. And my dad took me there, and we queued up for 45 minutes for a hamburger. It was a hamburger and a strawberry milkshake. And he said to me, son, that's how much confidence I've got in you. So I thought that was wonderful, and that was my dad's way of empowering me, giving me faith, giving me confidence, giving me belief that I can move on and deal and have these challenges. And oddly enough, I went to another club, Luton Town thereafter, and that was managed by a wonderful man called David Pleat, a Jewish manager, very, very good man, and I'm in touch with him. In fact, I spoke with him 2 days ago, and he actually then was the coach, and I was playing in a trial match, and I couldn't believe it because I scored 3 goals, and I thought, I'm in, I'm going to, and unfortunately, the same David Pleat said, sorry, son, you're not good enough. So, I went to Chelsea. There was a trial over Uxbridge. And there was an interesting guy there, the late Bobby Campbell, a wonderful man. I had a trial there, and I had the same message. Sorry, you're not good enough. I was devastated, but for some strange reason, I still knew I was going to make it. So, that faith from my father, it was a golden thread in my mindset that was aligned to me. And then I said to myself, my last throw of the dice, because I thought, okay, We'll give it a last throw. I was playing on Plumstead Common in southeast of England, and this Charlton scout, a wonderful man called Les Gore and Roy Passy, they came up to me and says, "Oh, you might be good for us." And I was thinking, my goodness me, is it going to be this all over again? So that was when I was 14 years of age. And then I went to Charlton, and as they say, the rest is history. Because at 16, I was a young man, or a baby in my mum's eyes, playing in a man's football. Because then I signed schoolboy forms and I became a professional at 16. As soon as I left school, straight into the first team, and I moved on. Now, what was interesting at that time, what did that society represent? It was a difficult time, if I'm being honest with you, because particularly in football, and if you look at the representation of society, what does society look like then? Football stadiums, communities, people. Those that know then, I'm sure many in this room do, it was a very, very difficult time in society for black players as well, because there was a strong representation of the BNP, we called them then the National Front. They had a strong visibility at stadiums. And many black players was a target for booing, monkey chanting. And I suppose I found that kind of challenging, but I remember some of the challenges my mum and dad had, first generation from Jamaica, coming to England then. And it was, you know, no blacks, you know, no dogs, no Irish, etc., etc., etc. And we sort of moved around. So in a way, that kind of gave me a kind of second skin to what I was going to equip myself for. And I remember, you know, I remember even some of the players then playing for Charlton. They were nice people. They're good people. But there were still one or two that were ignorant, didn't really understand what was permissible, what was offensive and what wasn't. And I remember this on my debut, and I say this, a particular player we were at Crystal Palace, and was having a pre-match meal. And this particular player, I was just sitting there with the others, and he says, have we got any coon flakes for Paul? Now, that was my first real experience. And if, you know what? I looked at this player, and I says, pardon? And he says, oh, Paul, it's only a laugh, and it's only a joke. I says, that's not a kind of joke. Is that acceptable to you? I said to him, supposing I was to be very offensive about him, whether it be his disability or sexuality or ethnicity or his background. And the whole room was silent. And then the manager came up to me and says, Paul, listen, don't worry, it's fine. And the player didn't apologise to me. I thought, okay. Now, that was my first experience. And I must admit, it hurt in there, because at 16, although I'm a baby playing in a man's world, in a man's football, you wouldn't really expect that. But then that was my lesson. And I'll tell you what, it was a very, very, very good lesson that held me well in my future life, in my future career. And thereafter, you know, I was of that generation. You had myself, Garth Crooks, Cyril Regis, the late Laurie Cunningham, Brendan Batson. We were that cohort of men, young men, that was playing around trying to establish ourselves in football. And I have to say, you know, some of the abuse was vicious. Because understanding it now, I'm a much more mature and sensible man, I hope, all I ever wanted was one thing. It's called equality of opportunity. Each and every one of you in this room, you work in a racism-free environment. Myself, as Paul Elliott, and all my other colleagues, the circumference of the stadium was where people watched the game. The pitch was my working environment. So I have that fundamental human right, like everybody else, to work in a racism-free environment and enjoy and apply my trade. But unfortunately, that was the challenges then, in the late 70s, early 80s. And there was no real legislative framework in place. There was no laws then. The law called the Football Offences Act developed further down the line. So we had these challenges, and it will be in South London, when we played against Millwall. I mean, I have to say, Leroy might testify to this, but Millwall over at the Den in South East London, that was a place, I wouldn't send my worst enemy there. And I don't have many. I've never played in such an intimidating, hostile environment in all my life. But it's hard to imagine if you think the demographics of that part of New Cross. It was largely, black, Asian, minority, ethnic community. So to have this little sectioned-off area that was so intimidating, I could not believe it. And I've seen some big, strong players go there, and it's not for the faint-hearted. But one thing I learned, I didn't, believe it or not, I didn't see myself as a victim. I just says, listen, I've got to be strong, I've got to be resilient, I've got to be mentally able, and what I'm going to do, I'm actually going to engage and raise my performance to the optimum level to demonstrate to them that they cannot penetrate me and influence my game. Now, that come from my dad, that come from my mum, who worked extremely hard. My dad was a labourer. Some of you would know, back in the day, he worked at Ford's over at East London. My mum was a nurse, a school teacher, and worked unbelievably hard just to provide for us. So you take those values, you take that inner strength into your life. Because as she said to me, Paul, to be even, you're going to have to work twice as hard. That was a fact, and in all honesty, I couldn't appreciate that at the time because I just took it on board and, something else that mum's saying, but I can see exactly what she meant. And then I travelled. I was very lucky. I got a great move from Charlton, went to Luton under this fantastic manager, David Pleat. So I said to him, oh, you want to sign me now? Because it was fascinating because I remember Lenny Lawrence was the manager then. And he said, Paul, there was stuff in the media about Arsenal are going to sign me. And he pulled me aside from training one day. He says, we've agreed terms to sell you because the club was in a lot of financial debt. And I'm thinking, Arsenal. And then he says, come into my office. Got into his office. I'm thinking, it's Arsenal. And then he sat down there and he says, with the utmost reluctance, Paul, we've agreed terms with Luton Town. And I felt like collapsing. Anyway, he took me to meet David Pleat. And I have to say, I said to him, David, you are the greatest salesman this earth ever produced. Because within 30 minutes, I went there with Arsenal in my head. I want to go to Arsenal. Within 35 minutes, I'm going to Luton Town. And I have to say, my time there was absolutely fantastic. And I enjoyed it. One of the reasons I enjoyed it, because I saw then, I understood more about the challenges, because black players then, we had about, at one point, we had 9 in the team. Unbelievable. This is back in 1983. And I remember a couple of games we played and we got beat, and obviously it's us that got the blame. But it was about, you know what, you said to yourself, it's about the opportunity. It's about maximising your talents with the best that you've got. And I didn't really see myself as a role model in any way, but it's just, I was just in the here and now at that juncture, moving forward. And so I did move forward. I moved on to Aston Villa, fantastic move, went on to Pisa in Italy, which I thought, well, you know, I learned to speak a new language and I discovered Pino Grigio, Shiraz, Pasta. And a wonderful way to learn and play football. And I'm not going to sort of bore you, but playing against the likes of your Maradonas and your Van Bastens and your Rudolit and all those wonderful players. And I remember trying to kick Maradona once, got myself sent off, which is true. And I remember saying to somebody that the nearest I got to him was when I shook his hands at the end of the game. Such was my afternoon. And then I went on to Celtic, which was, honestly, a wonderful move. The Scottish people, amongst the most nicest, the most honourable, the most sincerest I could ever meet. Cheers, I have to say that. What's that? Have I got you by? Good. He's going to tweet definitely something nice about me, isn't he? Right? I've marked the note. It was great, notwithstanding the challenges and I had there. And then, one of my experiences, I'm not going to say at what club, but it was when somebody, actually the first time I experienced somebody throwing a banana at me. And I thought, okay, I was having a bad day at the office, in all honesty. But I'm not saying I deserved the banana, but I remember I scored an own goal, somebody threw a banana at me, and what I'd done, This was my way of dealing with discrimination. I picked it up, peeled it, eaten it, threw it back at the party. And the whole crowd got in roars of laughter. And I remember at the end of the game, the actual the commentator was live on TV and whatever, and he says, Paul, you know, a typical classic game of football. First half, disastrous. Second half, you've played wonderfully well. And he said to me, what was the catalyst to your performance? What was the change? I said to him, it was nutritional potassium value in the banana. So my point was, I got away with that. But that was the way, if I'm being honest with you, how I approach dealing with challenges. I tried to make it humorous, tried not to let it be affect me. And then I went on to Chelsea, which was a fabulous move where I became their first black captain back in the early 90s. And that was challenging because of the historical element about Chelsea. But things changed in my life. I got a horrific injury and I had several operations on my knees. And the doctor said to me, well, sorry, Paul, you're not going to be able to play again. And I have to say that was a devastating blow. And what I didn't have was, where was that void in my life where you could engage with somebody, you know, talk to somebody, because football then was a lot different to the way it was now. And, you know, you had to be strong. In a way, you couldn't show weakness. So you were just a job. It's just a job. You're a commodity, you're in, you're out. And it's similar to what it is now, but there's different layers of potential services that are available and options that are available to young people. And I said to myself, well, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And I was absolutely devastated after that and playing for England, as schoolboy youth, under 21, England B level, and being injured. I felt devastated. And how could I cope mentally? That was my biggest challenge, the mental adjustment to say, where am I going to go next? And I suppose, if I'm honest with you, I suffered mentally as a consequence. Anybody would, with that sort of intensity, doing what you love doing, and all of a sudden, you know, through circumstances, it's just taken away from you, like life is sometimes. But that's the point, life. And I was mature enough to realise my wife, I had a challenging point in my life. Because within moments, when I got injured, my wife was expecting our first child. And in a way, can I say to you, I use the word blessing. Because that was my blessing. Because while football meant so much to me, it was in my DNA, it was everything that I'd done, the life of my baby, pending baby, that was my real gift from God. And it enabled me to focus. And I have to be honest with you to say, my wife really struggled with the birth. And we almost lost him. So that told me about what real life was about. It wasn't about Paul Elliott. It wasn't about Paul Elliott's career. It was about Paul Elliott's contribution to life, to society, and hopefully form part of my legacy. That was what it was about. So all of a sudden, I shifted my mindset. And I says, okay, what do I want to do now? Where do I want to go now? So I wanted to go and re-educate myself because I sacrificed my education. And through the work and the experiences that I felt, I wanted to turn negative into positive. So in 1993, the Kick It Out was born. Myself, Lou Dewsley, a wonderful man, a distinguished man of the highest order, was a leader of people. And another man of the highest order called Gordon Taylor. Gordon now is the current CEO of the Professional Footballers Association, one of the many entities that I sit on and try to serve. They were the catalyst. They were the catalyst to change. Because through that period, many black players had had the unfortunate experiences that I had. So this had to be a change to enable players to have that fundamental right to work in a free, racism-free environment. And it was putting that message out there. Because ultimately, there's a duty of care that players had to be born under. And that was, for me, the real changing face of football. And that continued right the way through. And then what we had thereafter was a legislative framework. We had the FA then we had the Premier League then the Football League. So all of the bodies then started to come on board because they fully understand. us players, any player. It wasn't just about being a black player, but also what happens if you're gay? What happens? Then that's when the agenda, the broader issues of discrimination started to come to the fore in the game. So I've been very lucky over the last 25 years or so. My work with UEFA, the PFA, the FA, FIFA, FAIR, which is Football Against Racism in Europe, FIFPro, which is the World Players Union, and, you know, it reverts back to my special love, Charlton Athletics. That's been so central to my world around equality, diversity, inclusion, using the power of football, because football has got an amazing power. But not just football, all sport. All sport has got a great power. And I think that enabled me then to sort of look forward and see what I call 21st evolution of sport, of the game, of society. And those that know, in the mid-90s, Sky announced its arrival, then the whole composition of stadiums changed. You know, the ugliness was out, the days of the National Front, the BNP, you know, the people behaving inappropriately. There's more diversity in stadiums, more people with disabilities, people from diverse backgrounds, international community. And people who are, you know, different nationalities, different sexualities. You know, football had to start to learn to stop being judgmental, because football had to start being inclusive for everyone. And ultimately, the composition of people in the circumference at the stadium, it was important that they reflected society and communities. That was the start of what I call real, progressive, measurable, sustainable change. And make no mistake, it's had its challenges. And one of the biggest challenges moving forward, when we looked at the composition of people, the diversity on the pitches, at the moment you've probably got 27, 28% of the players are black. But we've only got 4 or 5 black managers. We haven't got any more coaches at the elite level. So they're bigger challenges. So we've had to build a supply chain to come through, to be coached, to be educated. And then, you know, one of the biggest positives I've seen, the development of women and girls football. I think I've never seen, we can use the word evolution, but I think that's fantastic. And that's from grassroots to all levels. And I think we've got to go the next stage where that diversity hasn't just got to be reflected in the coaching and say that's good enough. Well, what inside the boardrooms? What about its administrators? And I note Tracy Crouch, our sports minister, she's actually saying about getting greater diversity in the boardrooms, more women inside the boardrooms, which is absolutely right. Because a lot of public money is being invested into the FA, as I understand, close to £30 million. And ultimately, you know, she's talking about targets. I don't think there should be targets, because we shouldn't be aligned. It's about skill sets. It's about inclusivity. If I have the skills, I should be there. Whether I'm black or white, or male or female, or lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or somebody with disabilities, who cares? Why is that relevant? Why do we have to label? Because we're all part of one race. It's called the human race. And the human race has to be engaged and integrated within sport if they so wish. So what there needs to be, which is the same challenges, is called transparency of processes. Because in my opinion, there is a lack of transparency, which is why you've had the same old types, the same old types, the same old types. But it's changing, it's evolving, because ultimately, one of the key things is legislation. Nobody's above the law. And ultimately, particularly where there's public money being invested, the same very people that are supposed to be the beneficiaries of that, why aren't they inclusive in the decision-making process where that money should go? So I think there's been a massive sea change. And I sense that, I call it one thing, it's called meritocracy. Because anybody wants to be judged on that. Nobody should have any favours. As long as there's a robust, open, transparent recruitment process, then the person with the right skill set should have that opportunity. However, the composition of the decision-making process still has to be reflected of the people that wants the very job. You can't have a certain type. It can't be all male. It can't be all black. Why isn't it not reflected in? That's the reflection of the diversity. It has to be all inclusive. So it comes back to that word, which is a very, very powerful word indeed. I think one of the other key challenges is people with disabilities, for them to have access to stadiums. They have the same rights as me, as everybody else. And it's that same fundamental right to be inclusive in this game, to be a participant or be a spectator of the game. As we all know, one of the other big challenges, homophobia. I mean, make no mistake, you know, there are Premier League players out there who are gay. And I have to say, I can go back to the 80s, my dear friend, Justin Fashanu, who sadly took his life. And that was one of the saddest moments in my whole career. So I look at the way that area has evolved, and I think there's some good work going on between all the stakeholders. Because what we have now in this 21st century, the Premier League, the FA, the Football League, the LMA, the PFA, everybody's working collaboratively, collectively, for the betterment of society and community, using the power of football to address, and the power of sport to address so many of those social changes. And I think it's been great that you've had Gareth Thomas in rugby, you've had Casey Stoney, Thomas Hitzberg, or Tom Daly in diving. These individuals have had the courage to come out and speak. And you know what? Should they really have to do that? Should it matter? But the sadness is they have to come out, and I admire them because they are powerful role models for what they stand for. And their sport, be it football, be it diving, be it rugby, they have that same right, that same duty of care. So when people are behaving inappropriately on the stands and shouting obscenities, hey, get them out, punish them. I'm a believer in education, I am. But I'm also a believer in zero tolerance, application of the law, particularly when it comes to adult behaviour. That's totally unacceptable. I think if we move forward, we can see the impact that foreign players have had on this country. I think it's been colossal. I think there's been some fabulous ones, wonderful ones, not so good ones. Personally, but they've made a huge overall, they've made a huge contribution. But you have to consider only 33% of the players in the Premier League qualify to play for England. So that leaves a challenge because that statistic doesn't lie. And I think looking forward politically, we've got to look at the Brexit ramifications. Whether your political allegiances are is not my business. But what I will say that since the Euro Championships, there was over 20,000 incidents reported on social media against people of different nationalities, against players, against managers. That's a colossal amount. And I think that's where we have to, there has to be a, we have to learn moving forward in the 21st century how to use not just the power of football, but the power of sport to mobilise people, break down barriers, heal tensions, engage, unite, challenge. Challenge discrimination, challenge ignorance, and educate people. And I think nobody knows when this Article 50 is activated next March, the ramifications, what it means and what it's going to look like. Nobody knows. But I think it reinforces the message that in the UK, this is a great country because I think we're very tolerant. I think we're very kind. I think we're very giving. We're very sharing. And we embrace diversity. We embrace difference because it's there for me to be celebrated. And I sense that that's going to be one of the biggest challenges moving forward in the 21st century. it would be remiss of me if I didn't speak about this forum, sports chaplaincy. As Matt said, I've known him for a few years, and I have to say, being utterly transparent, I wasn't aware of the magnitude of the work that they've done. The way it's grown from what I call an acorn, like a baby, to now an adult. And there's more to be done. And when Matt asked me to come and speak, I was delighted, because it gave me an insight into the excellent work that it does. And particularly, not just at the sort of pro level, you know, lower leagues, but in terms of women, in terms of disability, multi-sport, rugby league, tennis. It's inclusive. And also the international component to it as well. And I think its inclusivity makes such a positive contribution to sport and to society. And it's not just about, you know, the pastoral care around bereavement or around, you know, mental illness or adversity. It's not just about serving at the elite end of the game. Because make no mistake, there are big challenges there. What sports chaplaincy is, it represents independence, impartiality. It's non-judgmental. And there's such a focus on the individual's well-being that ordinarily you don't get. Because if you're in a football club, for example, you've got sports sciences, you've got doctors, you've got physios. You know, in my day, you know, you had nobody you could speak to. Because if you're going to speak to the physio, it's going to get back to the manager. If you speak to the doctor, it will get back to the manager. And then the manager, if things aren't going quite right at home, you've had a new child, and you know, the manager will be judgmental. But when you're speaking to one of the chaplains, you know, number one, it's confidential. Number two, they've got your best interests at heart. Number three, their impact on you is just to make you the best that you can be. Because they're not just thinking just throughout your football career, because the truth of the matter is, like my career, it started and it stops. So it's like life. Your life starts and one day it stops. So their care is continually evolving. And I think there's a huge vacuum, there's a huge hole missing in the game that I think they can fill. And I think that's because if you've got these young players that come through the game, the truth of the matter is, and I've seen all the data there, you know, a young boy that comes through the game at 18, he gets rejected. Sorry, son, you're not good enough. Where does he go? What does he do? Yes, there are opportunities to, via the PFA, to get involved in coaching and education, etc., etc., etc. But it's about the psychological well-being. That, for me, has become a real 21st century challenge. And I think what sports chaplaincy can give, you can give hope to a young person to say, well, I say, listen, you may not have made the grade at 18. Does that mean you're a failure in life when you've got another 40-odd years to live? The answer is no, it's not. But they need guidance, they need independence, and they need direction. Because football clubs are a business. While you're good and you have the competency to play football, you're fine. But when that disperses, you're out, somebody else comes in. It's a revolving, ruthless, clinical door. Sports chaplaincy, for me, is the comfort blanket. And I think that's critical. Because not only does it serve young players at that level to get them back on the straight and narrow, just to make them better human beings and helps them to cope with life and give them direction and give them purpose. Because so many of them, to be quite candid with you, they go off into drinks, they go off into alcohol abuse, they go off into drugs, they go off into bad company. And before their life's even started, it's completely derailed, just on the back of rejection. So it's about the broader, holistic input and impact on these young people to make them good and decent citizens to continue their life and turn a negative situation, if they deem it negative, into a positive, because then you have acquired the skill sets and the characteristics then to move forward. So these men and women that work within a sport chaplaincy, they're not looking at you because you're a great player, because you're an average player. They're looking at you as a person, as an individual, and concerned for your well-being. So then you've got the capability to go out there and lead your life in a very decent, honest and open way and cope. Because I have to say to you, the intensity, the pressure of being a modern-day player now is I've never seen anything like it. I have to be honest with you. Whilst part of me says, yeah, I'd love to be a modern-day footballer. I mean, the average wage for a Premier League player is £2 million. I mean, it's considerable. In my day, just say it was considerably less. But I'm not judgmental. What has money done? If you've got money, you use it wisely, judiciously, constructively to bless others. You know, everybody knows what we need. But once you've got what you need, what next? What else to do with it? So you empower other people's lives. You make change to other people's lives. You invest it. You don't make it your God. And that's what the people who are really blessed that think that way. And I think it goes, the sports chaplaincy model goes to the other extreme, where you've had a player, male or female, that's been an outstanding individual. And then, where does their life go at 32, 33, 34, 35? Particularly when you've had continual adulation. When you've had media, you've had intensity, you've had the whole world interested in you, your family, your third parties, you've had the column inches, you've had the social media. Where does life go next? And then it comes to an abrupt end. And I think that's even a bigger challenge than sometimes a young person, because you've seen it all, you've done it all, you've achieved it all, you've got a bank full of money. And the hardest problem then is psychological, mental well-being. And you find so many of them are involved in gambling. Another huge issue. So, and they haven't got anybody to relate to because they don't know, where do I go next? What do I do? So when we talk about the issues of mental well-being, it's not, people can say, oh, well, you're earning £60,000 a week or £100,000 a week, you've got a big car, you've got, you know, you've got a home, you've got everything, so why should you be depressed or have mental illness? It's absolute nonsense. Because we know, like a particular disease, it doesn't discriminate. Whether you're rich or you're poor, you're black or you're white, you've got different sexuality, you're lesbian, you're gay, you're bisexual, transgender, you're somebody with disabilities. If you get something, you get something. It's got no boundaries. And I think that's the direct correlation that people need to understand. Because you've had all that material, that doesn't mean then you're living a life full of roses. One of the greatest examples was he passed away 3 years ago, 4 months ago, Duke of Westminster. Third richest man in the country, worth a fortune of £8.4 billion, more money than we can ever count. Yet he was unwell, but I knew he continually suffered from depression. So I think that's a perfect example of one's mental well-being and the alignment, that there's no correlation between that and wealth. So I think the sports chaplaincy, I think, I use the pun, excuse it, it's a godsend. It's a present from God. It's a gift from God. Because I think it's got an independent, impartial, neutral role to play in all sports, across sports, for male, for female. And I think, if I'm honest with you, I'm honoured in a way to see what I call 21st evolution. And there's been so many changes in the game. And there's so many people now that work within football clubs. There's so many layers of parties inside a football club now than ever before. But I can say, as a strong, as a serious advocate of sports chaplaincy, it does everything what it says on the tin and even more. Thank the Lord. Praise the Lord. I just wanted to close by saying, I've always said in my life, you know, regardless of race, colour, creed, religion, gender, disability, sexuality, age, equality of opportunity is a fundamental God-given right. It's not a privilege. And it reminds me further of the great author, Helen Keller. Alone, we do so little. Together, we do so much more. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, Matt, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed talking to you. And God bless each and every one of you and your families. Thank you very much.
Paul, we're not letting you go yet.
Now I've got some questions, haven't
You've
I?
Got some questions. We've got 10 minutes left for questions.
Oh, 10 minutes? So. Oh my goodness.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Is that
That's all right. Hey.
First hand up over there, please.
Given the amounts of money that's being spent pulling in, to a large extent, players from outside the UK, and given what you said about encouraging meritocracy, are we in danger of seeing a new racism when England, I was going to say Wales, but don't forget about that. Are we in danger of seeing a new racism where we don't seem to be giving the opportunity for meritocracy to British-born players, given the way in which foreign players just seem to be flooding?
It is a challenge. It has to be a concern. I mean, one would hope, I think, where we have to be very careful because you have EU law, and as it stands, it's you know, the EU represents a single market of 28 countries where players are free to move around into, you know, the same way we have 3.5 million people out living, English people living in Europe. We want them to have the same equal rights and equal opportunities. So that has to be applicable in this country too. But I think when you speak to a lot of players, I think their concern has been the middle band ones. You know, the top ones, your Henrys, your Vieiras, you welcome them and the rest. But I think, me personally, there's been a lot of money that's gone outside of the game on average, on mediocrity, that I would love to see be invested more in grassroots facilities. That's one of our biggest problems. Facilities, grassroots, coaches, mentors. Sports chaplaincy.
Thanks, Paul. I'd be interested to hear your views from the sort of media perspective, really, just what your thoughts would be on how inclusive the media is in our country in covering the different forms of football. So, for example, we've just had the European Championships, wall-to-wall coverage, great for our nation of Wales that did well.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
But last summer in the UK, had the European Blind Football Championships.
That was in Hereford, wasn't it?
Yeah, I didn't see one game.
And
I look at athletics, I see Channel 4 up in their ante in terms of coverage of, but nothing for blind football. How can you influence the media?
I think we all live in a very commercial world, and ultimately, it's what sells newspapers. It's about audience, it's about numbers, it's about volume. And, you know, we know where football stands. It's the optimum because it's got a value, an unbelievable commercial value. The last TV rights worth £8.1 billion. So that sort of sums up the disparity. However, you know, you'd like to feel, I mean, it was covered because I'm aware of it. And wearing my UEFA hat, they were there. They sent, you know, various officers. And there was some matches there that was on TV. But I think we have to try and be realistic and live in, as much as we like to see these minority, smaller sports getting the press coverage, unfortunately, that's what's not going to sell newspapers or draw people to the TV. So that's just a unfortunate, harsh reality of life. But the fact that there's a consciousness about it, you know, and those smaller sports are much more in the fore now, and I think that's great. Like women and girls football, the fastest growing sport in the country. It's amazing. I've seen nothing like it. So I think that's great. It's never, you know, being realistic and honest, you know, I was at a Wembley when it was 70 odd thousand when the women's played, and I thought that was amazing and unbelievable. So that's showing the impact and the power of sport, you know, that can actually have on society. So we can only hope and pray that, you know, these minority sports are still being profiled in the way that we'd like them to be.
Thank you, Paul. Would you like to comment, or is it too premature? What would happen if all advertising of gambling is pushed through the watershed to after 9 o'clock? Do you envisage that being a crisis for the minority sports that benefit from the exposure at the top end?
I think it'd be extremely difficult because the reality is so many of them are dependent on it. And let's be honest with you, if it wasn't, it's interesting now I've seen the emergence of the Ladbrokes, the William Hills, all the various gambling entities, you know, in these very challenging economic times because there is a financial need for them. And I think potentially that's one of the root of the evil for people, particularly young players that's got more money than time. I mean, I'd love to see it be pushed later, but unfortunately, I just don't think it's commercially or economically viable. And I'm sure that will be a condition of their contractual obligation in order to attract their investment.
Well, yeah, I just would like to get your reflection on kind of the reality of life in the elite professional game. I'm not so sure that we've moved perhaps as far as we would like as far as tackling things like racism, sexism, homophobia. And partly I wonder if that's because player power is so great and the culture so strong that any young player who transitions into the first team, it's very hard for them to actually not just adapt and adopt the culture within which they end up. So what do you think more could be done to try and tackle some of those issues?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an excellent point because I've got friends, colleagues, who are gay. Just give an example, playing at Premier League level. Now, their challenge would be, they said to me, Paul, if I came out, every stadium I go, I'll get absolutely vilified, number one. Number two, their agents are actually saying, if you actually come out and say that you're gay, your commercial value would diminish substantially. And number three, they want trust. Trust. When you listen to the authorities actually say, we will support, we will have zero tolerance. If somebody comes out and says, I'm gay, and they're playing next week and they're going to be abused, they want the trust that the authorities are going to do exactly what they say they're going to do. Because the truth of the matter is, it's unlawful to use any form of discriminatory language within a football stadium or anywhere. So I think those three things, they need to have the confidence of that. And I think the game, not individually, collectively, has to do much more. Because I think, personally, if somebody came out and said they were gay, I know there's a culture in the dressing room. And I mean, there was a recent study by Kick It Out that they went around and talking to various people about the challenges that still happen, you know, the macho image, you know, that's still inside the dressing room. And I think that would be a big challenge because you've still got that layers of ignorance within the football structure. But I think that's where the FA, all the stakeholders, this is a collective responsibility. It's not an individual responsibility. And their leadership, consistent leadership and positive messaging is the key to this, to give somebody, whoever it is, to come out and say, I'm gay, so what? I'm a damn good player. I'm here. I'm making a positive contribution to this team. You respect me. Because I believe whoever these parties they elected to, if you know, I think they'll get respect by their players. I know there's always going to be one or two, but if you look at the broader picture, you know, when I had all the challenges that I had, people used to look at me different. But now, just saying, I'm Paul. Doesn't matter about my ethnicity, my background, what I look like, where I come from. So you get that respect. Especially, you know, that's why I respect, you know, I spoke about Casey Stoney, you know, Hitzberger, Gareth Thomas, you know, Tom Daly, you know, all in the different sports coming out and saying, hey, I'm good. But what I think what the game really wants is for somebody to come out in their prime. That's going to be the real, real challenge. And I hope that happens sooner than later.
One more question.
I live in Carlisle. I'm very proud to have Keith Curl as manager at Carlisle United. Yeah. He's doing a fantastic job. I'm wearing a New York City shirt where Patrick Vieira is doing tremendously well. But there seems to be a real lack of people from ethnic minorities in management and senior coaching roles. How can that be changed?
Yeah, well, thank you. That's been one of the big challenges in football at the moment. There's a lot of work going on within the FA, I know, with the PFA doing some great work. I think there is a capacity build going on. The Premier League are doing their work. They call it the EPPP. But I think what we need, when we use the word inclusion, I always say, you can't have inclusion unless you have visibility. That defines inclusion. And unfortunately, at the moment, we've got the 27, 28% on the field. We've got three or four black managers, coaches. It's been like that for the last 15 years. And I think until the supply chain that's coming through comes through, gets the opportunities, then we're still going to be talking about the same subject in 5, 7, 10 years' time. So whilst there's a lot of good work going on, really, I know, because I'm at the vanguard of seeing the progress. Ultimately, for all the mentoring, all the coaching, all the upskilling, you know, Wayne Allison's doing some great work at the FA. I know Mike's doing some great work at the PFA. I know there's a lot of good work going on. But ultimately, Judgment Day is going to be in terms of accountability and visibility when we see those next cohorts of the next generation coming through. And I think you have to look at the top end. The average lifespan of a manager now is 10, 11 months. So a lot of the chairmen come in, they're not thinking, well, I'm going to give this young person a chance, an opportunity. I mean, my favourite team, Charlton, you had Chris Powell there for a time. A new owner come in, he was there a short while, he moved on. But it's great now that he's going to get back into the game. But, you know, look how long it's taken Chris to get there. But I'd say to these players, get yourself qualified first and foremost. Give nobody the excuse. Education is key. Be dedicated, be focused, and work hard. And sooner or later, because I've seen it, you know, with my own self on my own journey, you can only get knocked down so much, and you've got to get up, dust yourself down, and keep going and keep persevering. Because I don't want to sound too negative, because I can see my journey and how it's been. But I genuinely believe, in this 21st century where we are, there are some tremendous opportunities. But not just to be coaches, but to work within other areas within a football club. So whilst everybody wants to be a coach at grassroots and elite, not everybody can be a coach. You've got 20 Premier League clubs. You've got another 72 Football League clubs. So there's only 92 clubs. and 20 of the clubs, they've all got, you know, international coaches. So it's you know, there's only then potentially how many jobs available. So you have to proportionalise it. But I do hope it comes back to meritocracy, transparency of recruitment processes, and you know what? Giving young people a chance. Giving them a chance, believe in them, and give them an opportunity. And that's where meritocracy comes key.